heads up before we start the show, especially if you have kids within hearing distance, we discuss child sexual abuse and pedophilia in this episode. Okay, here's the show. When Alyssa created an Instagram account for her 11-year-old daughter in 2020, there really wasn't a lot going on.
It was during the pandemic, and her daughter was interested in photography and fashion, and they were kind of stuck at home and bored.
That's Jennifer Valentino DeVries, a reporter at the New York Times.
A lot of parents in this world get into this in a similar way. Their child is in some sort of activity, and where there are other children who are influencers, and the attire in the activities and the equipment and so forth is quite expensive. And they realize that they can get discounts on this by posting the children, you know, wearing this clothing on Instagram.
At first, Alyssa kept her daughter's account private. But the idea that her child could become an influencer and scoop up some brand deals was tempting.
To get these brand deals and have this activity, she turned her daughter's account to public. And, you know, they started getting more followers and, you know, they thought it was just a fun activity. But I think over time, it became clear that a lot of these followers were men.
Jennifer spoke to dozens of parents like Alyssa. She discovered scores of men following the child influencers. In Telegram channels monitored by the Times, men openly fantasized about sexually abusing the young girls they were following on Instagram. Often, they'd leave sexually charged comments on the girls' posts. But most of the content on the girls' accounts isn't sexual. It's just girls being girls, posing in leotards or other dance outfits, showing off their interest in fashion, trying to be like the older girls and women they know. But for child predators, these accounts are a goldmine, an opportunity to try and get whatever they can from these kids, typically through their moms. In Alyssa's case, one man tried to blackmail her into sending sexually explicit photos of her daughter to him.
Somebody started messaging them, threatening to expose them to like their brands and their school and the police, saying that, you know, I know you sell naughty pictures to pedophiles. And there were not, as far as we could see, any actual naughty pictures. There was nothing illegal, nothing even, you know, in like a string bikini or anything. But somebody thought that there was this illegal content out there and they wanted it for themselves. And so they were going to threaten the parents with exposing them unless the parents shared this illegal content with them. And eventually the person did send a letter with a couple of Instagram photos to the girls' school and to their brands and so forth.
To be clear, the photos weren't explicit. They showed Alyssa's daughter having fun, wearing dresses, high-end workout gear, and dance leotards. But because the man told the school they were part of a cache of sexual photos, the school questioned Alyssa's daughter anyway.
She was very upset and sort of traumatized by being questioned about her Instagram account.
Alyssa's story is one of many. Jennifer and her Times colleagues examined 5,000 child influencer accounts and discovered 32 million connections to male followers. Their investigation raises thorny questions about why we post and who is responsible when images of children go to dark places online.
There was definitely a set of parents who wanted to give men the benefit of the doubt if they were following and commenting on their children.
Sounds like a bit of delusion to me. If your 11-year-old daughter has 100,000 followers, many of them male, you got to be thinking, why?
Alyssa did ultimately conclude that a lot of these guys were pedophiles. Her feeling was that they weren't posting anything wrong and that they wanted to stay on social media, but not have the pedophile followers. And I think it is just extremely difficult to do that.
So today on the show, creeps are flooding the accounts of child influencers. Who's to blame? and who can make them stop? I'm Emily Peck, filling in for Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about tech, power, and how the future will be determined. Stick around. For their investigation, Jennifer and her colleagues looked at child influencer accounts with 500 or more followers and that featured children in form-fitting and revealing attire. There were a lot.
It is much more prevalent than I would have thought prior to starting this story. I think a lot of parents who want their kids to be in modeling or dance or acting, I think it has drawn any of the types of parents who you would ordinarily consider like stage parents or dance moms are getting into this. And that is, you know, a pretty sizable number of people.
So it's like those beauty pageant moms, the moms that taking their kids to be child models, child actors. Now you sort of have to have this social media presence, but that just poses all kinds of, I mean, just kind of gross dangers, I guess, to the kids.
You know, there have always been stage parents and parents who were interested in getting these kinds of opportunities or careers for their children in terms of fame or certain entertainment industry roles. But social media has really supercharged that. It's made it much more accessible to anybody. You can be anywhere in the United States. You don't have to move yourself to Los Angeles or New York City and get an agent and spend all your time going to auditions. You can just stay where you are and post images on Instagram and get kind of a taste of this fame. We all know the dangers that child stars face, right? I mean, that's been discussed for ages. I think that there are some similar dangers that are being faced by these influencer children, but it's so much more widespread now than back when like Brooke Shields or somebody was growing up.
The content on these accounts depends a lot on the child's interests, but typically the young girls and their parents come from the world of dance or gymnastics.
You might have accounts that are of a young gymnast and they're wanting to sell leotards. So you just have picture after picture of the girl standing there with her hands on her hips or turned around and looking over her shoulder and wearing a one-piece leotard. Or if they're in competitive dance, you know, they have these vibrant outfits that are sometimes two-piece leotards. So it looks almost like a two-piece bathing suit, not like a tiny bikini necessarily, but or a one-piece bathing suit. And they are doing dance moves that are very impressive, but they're showing their flexibility. So they'll be doing the splits or raising their leg up by their head or, you know, doing a crazy back bend.
Sure.
And then there are accounts that are really the kids in more minimal clothing, like bikinis, but these are not as many. Like, I would say most of the accounts are gymnastics, dance. Maybe they're wearing like crop tops and a little skirt or something, which is really popular in fashion right now. But what they have in common is that they're all really focused on the child's body and appearance because they're sort of modeling this attire. Mm-hmm. And so the focus is on that.
Arguably, the biggest driver for child influencers to go public is the possibility of brand deals and the financial incentives that come with that. Some of the moms Jennifer interviewed said they set up their daughters' accounts in order to help them pay for college or pad their savings. But more often, the brands sponsoring these influencers are small, and influencers aren't making a ton of money.
These are small companies. We're not talking about like Target or Walmart or something like that. Mm-hmm. One of the things that really surprised me, like I was thinking that, oh, all these parents must be making a ton of money and that's why they're willing to put up with this. But no. No, the majority of parents, all they're getting is like maybe some free stuff, like or discounted stuff, or just the opportunity to say, like some of these ambassador programs, you don't really even get much of anything. You just kind of get to say you're an ambassador. So it's like this feeling of winning something, I think.
It's just marketing for the brands.
It's not just marketing really... for the brands. Yeah. Yeah. It's just marketing for these brands. you know, then there are people who, once you get a larger following, you know, they're able to charge like a couple thousand dollars for a post, right? Which is good money. And some parents spoke with us and said, you know, they've got, their kids have gotten modeling gigs from it, or, you know, opportunities to work with choreographers and go to dance programs, and, you know, that they're using this to put aside for their child's education and that sort of thing. And then the other part of the ecosystem is, you know, you can get money from subscriptions on Instagram. And then there are these other platforms. We talked about one called Brand Army, where you can charge fees for photos, like pay-per-view type fees for photo sets, subscription fees for photo sets. You can charge for direct messages. You know, there are different ways to monetize the more direct interactions with, they call them fans, and sales of the child's images, like not even serving as advertising, just selling a portfolio of images to someone. And in those cases, there was like a very small number, like a handful, half a dozen families where they were earning like six figures a year.
Those families must know why people are paying, you know, $10 a month or paying for images of their daughters. That they must know that that goes beyond just cheering on some young gymnast.
I've talked with parents who offer subscriptions and say, we've talked about it and we don't know why they're doing this. And some of them, I think their thinking is that the photos they're putting out, it's not really salacious, or the child in dresses and not like a string bikini or something. And so what they say is, well, why would a pedophile be interested in that? There's nothing wrong with this content. So maybe they're just, you know, have some other reason for it. I know. I say it and I'm just trying to relay what they said. But they've talked about this. So there are other parents who are definitely, their child is in bikinis all the time. And their response is that their daughter wants to be a bikini model, or their daughter wants to be a model. And so this, their dream is to be in like a swimsuit magazine or something like that. And that's been their dream since they were young, and that's what they're going to do. And that they really lean very heavily on the idea that what they're doing is not illegal.
You mentioned Alyssa's account had 100,000 followers. Is that typical?
Most of the accounts that we looked at in our universe of 5,000 had fewer than 10,000 followers. I look at this as kind of a funnel. You have people who are just getting into this. They don't maybe know what they're getting into. They start blocking men because Instagram's algorithm serves up pictures of girls in minimal clothing to whoever their audience is who likes pictures of girls in minimal clothing. These parents have to spend hours blocking these guys. Once you get over like 10,000, 15,000 followers, and either you've decided you're going to grow your account, that's important, you want your kids to have more followers so they can get more brand deals or more attention or whatever, it looks good to have a lot of followers. Or you just become overwhelmed, you know, you've got a job or you're a single mom or something. That's when you start getting a higher and higher percentage of men. There are not as many accounts that have more than 100,000 followers, right? That's a pretty small percentage of our accounts had that many followers. But once you get over that number, you're more likely to have a lot of men. So you would have quite a few accounts that were more than half men, or 75%. The highest percentage we got to of men was like 90% were the ones following this account. And it was, you know, these were accounts with like hundreds of thousands of followers and girls in bikinis riding, like sitting on a motorcycle.
You did speak to some girls. I mean, how do they feel about this and this kind of attention?
So the girls who we did speak with, and of course they're minors, so we only spoke with them with their parents' permission, are not girls who are in string bikinis on motorcycles, right? We didn't talk to those children, right? And those people are...
They were not eager to speak to you.
No. So the ones we did talk to, you know, their parents are either blocking or the parents are handling the account. And the way they see it is, this is fun for them. Like, they are in dance or cheerleading or whatever already. And so you can kind of see it from like you're a 12-year-old girl. Your experience with this is that every once in a while, you know, you get dressed up, you take some super cute photos, mom puts them online, people love them, you can see that they're getting a lot of likes. You don't go into the DMs, like your parents are the ones who are handling that. Mm-hmm. And then later on, you get a coupon for a leotard you want. So it sounds super fun to them. Like right. That's their experience with it.
When we come back, what role does Meta play in protecting these kids? The elephant in the room here is obviously Meta, which owns Instagram. Mm-hmm. You flagged some accounts to them. You reached out to them. What are they saying about all this?
Their response kind of was in two parts, one of which is not surprising, you know, talking about how the resources they're putting to keeping bad content off their platform and that sort of thing. Although honestly, I mean, we've made so many reports. We know parents have made just countless reports that only a tiny percentage get actually acted on, right? So that was part of Meta's response.
So they're like, we work really hard. We filter a lot. Like yeah. We're on it. We're on it, yeah. Jennifer.
Right. The other part of their response though was basically like, you know, this is parents' choice to put this on there. And if they don't want that, basically they can leave at any time, that they can shut down their account whenever they want, that nobody's forcing them to be on there, which on one hand, yes. On the other hand, if you are going to offer your services to people like this and try to attract creators and influencers to your platform and offer them the ability to have subscriptions, even on these parent-run accounts that are really just featuring entirely children, you know, I think making sure that it is safer than it currently is something that I as a user would, you know, expect of a company.
You had one man quoted in your piece saying that the advent of Instagram heralds a golden age for child exploitation. I mean, is there something particular about Instagram that would make him say that?
We spent a lot of time looking at Telegram groups, like places, forums where men who are attracted to children and minors, you know, congregate and discuss these images. And so we read through a lot of those, and I think their take on it was that they really loved how Instagram's Explore page just fed them the exact content they wanted, and that this was happening more on Instagram than on TikTok and other platforms. But when it comes to Instagram, they were, yeah, really pleased that the algorithm could tell that they were interested in scantily clad children, and that's what it served them over and over and over, without apparent regard to like what was being served. You know, it's just an algorithmic decision, right? There's nobody sitting there saying like, this is scantily clad content of children. It just knows kind of who's going to like this type of image. And also, you know, these brands really like Instagram. We heard from a lot of parents that when it comes to accounts that parents are managing for their children, which is generally what it has to be at this age, if you're like 10, 11, even up to 13, like TikTok, they said was more likely to kick them off much more quickly. And they also found Instagram easier to use than TikTok. You know, you're on TikTok, it's not just still images that you take of somebody else. It's usually like you have to be active, and it's like a first person sort of image often. And that was too difficult for them. So it's kind of this perfect storm of it's happening on Instagram. That is where it happens.
And also, according to the Wall Street Journal, TikTok, OnlyFans, Patreon, they don't even allow paid subscriptions for content of children the way Meta does. And I think according to the journal's reporting, Meta is pretty aware that allowing paid subscriptions for, you know, images of children leads down this kind of dark path, but hasn't really addressed it. What is their interest in allowing these kinds of subscriptions? What is like the business strategy going on here?
I think that they do want younger people using the platform. When it comes to this specific question of like why they're allowing this specific thing. They, you know, just said that they've always allowed parents to post images of their kid and that, you know, they don't allow the children to be on there themselves. That's their safety step, is that it's not the kids themselves, it's the parents. And, you know, I think that they're interested in encouraging influencers and creators of all types. Mm-hmm. And this falls under that. They're also interested in drawing a younger audience. That's always a huge issue with any of these platforms, because other platforms come up and attract the younger audience. And so you're in this constant battle to have an audience that isn't aging. Like, I understand that those things are important. What confuses me still is how those goals, which I understand, are not outweighed by the risks, right? Like, even if you have those goals, you still have to make a risk calculation about them. And I'm not clear on why they've come down, like why those goals would outweigh the risks in this situation. I think one thing our reporting showed, though, was that these sorts of phenomena were occurring on Instagram even before subscriptions rolled out in 2022. So I think that's important to note. It's not, subscriptions did not cause this problem at all. And a relatively small proportion of the accounts have subscriptions enabled.
We reached out to Meta to ask them about their responsibility here. And in an email to us, they said they do root out potential child predators on the platform. And as for the question of why they allow paid subscriptions on children's accounts, a Meta spokesperson said that accounts that represent someone under 13, quote, must be actively managed by a parent or manager who is responsible for the content posted and can decide to delete the account at any time, end quote. On top of that, they said, quote, we prevent accounts that show potentially suspicious behavior from using our monetization tools, and we plan to limit such accounts from accessing subscription content. So, like, all of this is happening at a time when lawmakers are really focused on child safety online. Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Meta, was just at Congress apologizing to parents for various things. Are policymakers taking more action over this in light of your investigation?
There's a set of lawsuits right now from state attorneys general and other, you know, very large set of lawsuits against Meta and other social media companies regarding their attitudes towards children on their platforms and the lack of safety and lack of protection of children. And I think that those policymakers have now started looking more into safety issues with even parent-run accounts and what Meta and, you know, other platforms might be doing in that regard. Congress has been debating laws related to the same issue for several years. The problem with the laws that are being discussed is that, you know, it's not clear kind of what real effect they would have. And I've been covering tech for a really long time now. I'm just to the point where, like, I'm not holding my breath. Like, great. I mean, maybe there will be a law. Like, maybe something will actually happen one day.
So if we can't expect action from Congress, can we expect to see something from Meta? Jennifer is skeptical.
I think there are signs that, you know, they've faced so much criticism for so many years over so many things, and they're kind of just done with that. And, you know, I think there are people there who feel like no matter what they do, they'll get criticized. You know, if they start taking down a lot of accounts, they get criticized for being too restrictive and not allowing free speech. And it can be a tough situation for them. In some respects, I mean, I say that also, you know, they make a lot of money. They could be spending more money on moderating things. And a lot of times we'll point to the fact that, you know, there's such a huge platform. They handle so many pieces of information. Destructive behavior on their platform is a relatively small percentage of the total, which is true. And, you know, how could they possibly handle all of this? And my reaction to that is like, you're the one who decided to have like this many users. It's not like, you know, anybody's forcing you to be this successful.
At one point in your piece, someone's mom says she was told by the FBI to just get off social media. Like, and I'm not blaming the parents here, but I mean, just get off social. What is social media doing to people?
Yeah, it's making us all crazy. I mean, I feel it too, even when I'm just like for work, having to post on, you know, Twitter or Threads or whatever it is now. Ugh, you know, it makes you insane. You know, I think that in some ways they feel like they need to be on social media for various reasons. And I think that that mom was very concerned that even the FBI could not ultimately really help her or these other parents who were facing threats or stalkers or whatever, and just told them to get off of social media. So I think it does speak to, in some ways, the intractability of that problem and how people online can hide behind different personas and how law enforcement, you know, is not necessarily going to be able to respond to bad things that are happening online. If even the FBI is like, the solution is to just stop. I think that says a lot about how difficult it is to find a solution, but also like, yeah, how dangerous it is. The FBI just can't, they can't stop it. So yeah, maybe it's just not a good idea to get involved at all.
I also wanted to ask you, and I think about this because my daughter just turned 13, and I think about this a lot, and your story just reinforced it. I mean, all these girls dressing up in these, in this, you know, like skimpy clothes and like posing for the camera and getting likes and like getting that positive reinforcement about their looks. There's just something happening here with these platforms and these parents and these girls sort of being encouraged to kind of sexualize their appearance, to be very in line with whatever gender norms there are. And it's also amped up. I mean, Is there something bigger here going on too? Like, are these specific like child influencers just like a very extreme version of what social media platforms are doing to like young girls writ large?
Yeah, I think that was part of the impetus for this story was, you know, seeing these child influencers as almost like the tip of the spear of what is happening with girls and social media and this trickle down of influencer culture into younger and younger ages. And I think that, yeah, these girls are mimicking in a lot of ways adult female influencers. And there's a real tension here because, you know, if you're a grown woman, like you can do whatever you want, I think, with your body, and can sell underwear online, like that's whatever. But especially when you're talking about younger girls emulating that and seeing this as in this new economy, what their career options are, I think as a society, you know, it's just important to think about how that is affecting them, what that is telling them about like what their worth is and how responsive they need to be to people online and to men in general. You know, I think there are just a lot of broader societal questions that this investigation, I think, raised for me. And like, it's easy to just be like, blame the parents for this. These are crazy parents. I would never do this. But like, I also feel like, well, no, there are really deep currents here that are changing the ways that girls think about themselves and are presenting themselves to the world.
Jennifer, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Valentino DeVries is an investigative reporter at the New York Times. And that's it for our show today. What Next TBD is produced by Evan Campbell, Anna Phillips, and Patrick Fort. Our show is edited by Paige Osborne. Alicia Montgomery is vice president of audio for Slate. TBD is part of the larger What Next family. TBD is also part of Future Tense, a partnership of Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. If you're a fan of the show, I have a request for you. Become a Slate Plus member. Just head on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. We'll be back next week with more episodes. I'm Emily Peck, filling in for Lizzie O'Leary, and you can catch me over on Slate Money every Saturday. Thanks for listening.